Turn to somebody right now and tell them at least one thing that you're grateful for. Thank you so much. Some of you are more grateful than others. Some of you eked out one thing to be grateful for. No, I'm just kidding. But I am grateful for all of you. I missed being with you last week. I did. I didn't miss the snow. I missed you. I was very specific. I wish I could have had all of you in Cabo. We could have done this on the beach. It could have been kind of fun. Last week when I filmed that video that you got to see the week before when I had filmed it, I filmed it during a time when over in Paris, strange, violent, evil things were happening. Of course, I didn't know that at the time that I was filming, and that's partially what Solomon's all about. Can't control this. There's nothing about this life or this world that you can control. God controls things, but even that is a mystery, and the more we try to think about that, the more mysterious it becomes. And so just a couple of thoughts about that, and then we'll get into Ecclesiastes. First, it's a horrible, shocking, violent, evil, terrible, sinful, broken, dark, I don't know all the words I could pile up to think about Paris, to think about Brussels, to think about an Egyptian airliner that was shot down weeks before that, to think about 9/11, to think about all the violence and all of that stuff. And so when I was in Cabo, I met a couple of people, and they, of course, asked me what I do and shared with them that I was a pastor, and somehow we got on the topic of Paris, and they were saying, you know, it's not right to blame that on Muslims, and we got into this wonderful conversation. I said, no, all Muslims are not responsible, but some Muslims are. And unless you confront that through a Muslim lens, you can't stop it. And he said, no. He started getting all angry at me, and he said, that's like saying that the Ku Klux Klan was representative of Christianity during the Civil Rights Movement. I said, precisely. They were Christians, and they were using this book to justify their actions. That means somebody else who knows this book needs to say, you know what, let me show you what you're talking about in context. Let me show you the words of Jesus to tell you that you're wrong. So it's not that all Muslims are radical. It's not that all Muslims want to bomb people. But a Muslim needs to speak to Muslims, because the underlying theology is, if you have not read about ISIS, is that this is their version of Revelation. This is their version of the apocalypse. They think they are tapping on the doors of heaven, and one day soon, like maybe tomorrow or in the next few weeks, Allah will show up and will decimate the great Satan, the West. That's us. You have to have Muslims arguing with Muslims to say, no, that's not the wider spectrum of Islamic teaching. That's why, and the guy kind of got angry at me, and I said, think about it with me. The civil rights movement didn't have its break until the March at Selma, where Dr. Martin Luther King, a Christian, an African-American pastor, took a march to Selma, and that horrible, shocking scene where they got beat up by the state police and they got stopped, and then they were going to go the next day, and Martin Luther King had some intuitive kind of word from the Spirit, and he said, no, we can't go. And he bowed down on the highway and prayed. And then the next day he got on television, which was just starting to be this widespread new media, and he said, I need Christian brothers and sisters to stand with us. and white pastors from Boston and Baltimore and New York and Los Angeles and you name it, and a handful of white Jewish rabbis came down to Selma and marched with him. And it was then that there was a break, that there was a move, because Christians said, no, you can't do this kind of stuff in the name of Jesus. So all of that to say that Solomon speaks to us in a world that really requires wisdom. And wisdom requires that we don't blame all Muslims, but that we don't go to the other extreme and say that that doesn't have anything to do with it, because it does. They're clearly willing to die because they believe Allah will reward them for that. And it takes another Muslim to say, no, that's not the deepest part of our theology if that's the case. So that was my conversation with this guy on the dive boat. And then, then we got back to the business of being in a boat on the Pacific and diving. So I thought I'd show you what that looked like. Yes, that's me. So I show you that because I thought it might lighten the mood just a little bit, but that is happening in the context of us having these conversations about Paris. And they were good conversations. There was you saw them in the video. I was taking video of a couple. It's an Israeli couple. And they had moved to San Diego some years before, but they were from Israel. And they had an interesting perspective on this. They said, you know, in Israel, we expect these things every day and we go on living, because we can't completely stop them. I mean, we work to stop these things, and we hope that there's one day where the lion will lay down with the lamb and the swords will be beat into plowshares and all of that good stuff, quoting great biblical metaphors from the prophets. But they said, we recognize that until the day when Jehovah brings an end to all this nonsense, we have to go on living, and Jewish people have a perspective on that. We're not going to let this stop us. We're not gonna let fear override our lives. We have to raise our kids and be who we are, and that's what we're gonna do. That's our mark in the world, to say, no matter what you've done, and you've done a lot to us as Jewish people over the centuries, we're gonna keep on living. And so I thought about that because we wept a little bit for Paris. We said, could we just have a moment on the boat where we just say, this is a horrible thing? And then I was able to share a little bit from Solomon's wisdom, where he says, you can't predict these things, you can't control them, so you better have joy. You better go out and live. Live. In spite of the fact that this happens in Paris, and that doesn't diminish the sadness or grief at all. I thought, wow, am I justified in having this week in Cabo San Lucas, where it's 85 degrees and the Pacific Ocean is 81 degrees? Should I do that? And then I remembered that every week I've put in our Thrive series, a day of self-care. And for me, that's self-care. When I go under the water, it's like a reset. it reminds me that in spite of all the junk that's happening in the world, it's been happening since Cain and Abel. That's a long time. And it will continue happening long after I'm gone. And in spite of all these big headlines, there's a whole bunch of wonderful stuff happening around the world, but that doesn't make news. Because the way that you put things in the news is if it bleeds, it leads. So we don't always hear about the wonderful things, the marriages happening, the babies being born, the kids graduating from school, the promotions that are happening, the projects that are going forward, the creative breakthroughs in science, the wonderful inventions, the fact that longevity is up, that this century we expect longevity of human life to be better than any time in human history. There's a lot of good things happening in the world. And that's Solomon's point. It's all mixed together. And so we have to have times where we care for ourselves. Because if we don't, we can't care for anybody else. If I just focus on the brokenness and the pain, and there's a lot, then I start to become cynical, I start to become jaded, I start to become angry, and then I can't serve. Then I'm not a very good pastor. I'm not a very good husband. I'm not a very good father or a very good grandfather. And I just let me suggest that to you, whether you're doing the journaling or not or any of that stuff, make sure you take this self-care thing seriously. Several of you have said that's one of the hardest things to do. I understand. Press into it. Take care of yourself. Whatever that, for me, it's diving every once in a while. It's a reset for my soul. What is it for you? Is it journaling? Is it writing? Is it gardening? Is it cooking? Is it sewing? Is it painting? Is it singing? Is it fitness? Is it aerobics? Is it Zumba? Whatever it is for you, please, sisters, please, please, please care for your soul. You don't help the cause of Jesus Christ in the world if you're not healthy and whole. You don't help the cause of Jesus Christ in the world if you're not healthy and whole. So that's why I show you that. Let's jump into Solomon's words for today, and we're in Ecclesiastes chapter 10, and I'm going to read it to you from the Message. Because sometimes the Message, as I've said before, the paraphrase of Eugene Peterson helps bring it into a contemporary framework. If you read through this in any other translation, you may have scratched your head a little bit because the metaphors are ancient. These are 3,000-year-old metaphors. They're from a Hebrew Mediterranean culture, and we don't use the same metaphors. If I said to you, it's going to rain cats and dogs tomorrow, would you know what I meant? If I said to you, one day in Cabo, it was hotter than a cat on a hot tin roof, would you understand that metaphor? Solomon wouldn't, because he's not part of this culture. Vice versa, it's hard for us to come into these Hebrew colloquialisms, but every person who read this when Solomon wrote it would have said, ha, I get it, and they'd have laughed, and they'd have elbowed each other, because these are Hebrew colloquialisms. And the Message sometimes bring those forth. So let me read Ecclesiastes 10 from the Message. Dead flies in perfume make it stink, and a little foolishness decomposes much wisdom. Wise thinking leads to right living. Stupid thinking leads to wrong living. Kind of straightforward there. Fools on the road have no sense of direction. They walk, the way they walk tells the story. There goes the fool again. If a ruler loses his temper against you, don't panic. A calm disposition quiets intemperate rage. Here's a piece of bad business I've seen on this earth. An error that can be blamed on whoever's in charge. Immaturity is given a place of prominence, while maturity is sometimes made to take a back seat. I've seen unproven upstarts riding in style, while the experienced veterans are put out to pasture. Caution, the trap you set might catch you. Warning, your accomplice in crime might double-cross you. I'm at verse 9 now. Safety first. Quarrying stones is dangerous work. Be alert. Chopping down trees is hazardous. Remember, the duller the axe, the harder the work. Use your head. The more brains, the less muscle. If the snake bites before it's been charmed, what's the point in then sending for the snake charmer? You see, now you're, yeah, it's kind of funny in a way. The words of a wise person are gracious. The talk of a fool self-destructs. They start out talking nonsense and end up spouting insanity and evil. Fools talk way too much, chattering stuff they know nothing about. Okay, how many of you have an image of someone in your mind right now? Don't tell anybody who it is. A decent day's work so fatigues a fool that they can't even find their way back to town. Unlucky is the land whose king is a young pup and whose princes party all night long. Lucky is the land whose king is wise and mature, where the princes behave themselves and don't drink themselves silly. A shiftless person lives in a tumble-down shack. A lazy woman ends up with a leaky roof. But laughter and bread go together, and wine gives sparkle to life. But it's money that makes the world go round. Don't badmouth your leaders, not even under your breath, and don't abuse your betters, even in the privacy of your home. Loose talk has a way of getting picked up and spread around. Little birds drop the crumbs of your gossip far and wide. So it sounds, at least a little bit from the beginning, that it's kind of rambling. But what Solomon has done is he's taken us all the way to the edge last week of the abyss, where we talked about death. I mean, is there a deeper, darker, tougher subject to talk about? And now he's saying, in light of that, and in light of the fact that I've told you, go live, here's some practical wisdom for daily living out your life. And these start to sound a lot like another book that Solomon is famous for writing, the Proverbs. Those are usually one or two or sometimes three, four sentence Proverbs that say, in this situation in life, it would be best to live this way, not that way. There are colloquialisms and proverbs. We've talked a little bit about that before, so let's tease these out. First, he says, dead flies make a perfume stink. How many of you like perfume? How many of you have a favorite perfume? Okay, so think in your mind, when would you wear that? Would you wear it to a fancy ball, or would you wear it out, maybe celebrating with your spouse, or you'd wear it to a wedding, or sometime when you're getting dressed up. So imagine this. Imagine you got a new dress, and it's looking good. I'm serious, it's looking good. And you got new shoes, and they match, and your bag matches the shoes, and the hair, oh, it hasn't looked better in a long time. And the makeup just goes on like, wow, why can't I do this every day? And you go to pick up your favorite perfume, and you pick up the bottle and you look at it, and just as you're about to spray, you go, ew, because there's dead flies swimming around in it. How many of you would then spray it on your face? How many of you would throw it away and go get another perfume? That's what he's saying. Wisdom is like the perfume. It's wonderful. You might have it. You might have lots of it. But all it takes is a little bit of foolishness to mess up the whole jar. That's all it takes. Think about that. Do you know any situation in life, somebody that you know, or maybe you in your own life? Think about one little thing you did that then cost you big time. You just made that one mistake. You did something a little bit foolish. I mean, most of us probably have a handful of those. But you might have lived really well up until that point in time, and then just a little bit of foolishness can wipe out the whole thing. And that seems unfair, but it's the case. And Solomon could say, a little foolishness messes up a lot of wisdom. Or he can say, imagine your bottle of favorite perfume. What if there were stinky flies in it? Would you use it? Well, that's a powerful metaphor because it gets us right in the gut. We're like, ugh, ick. Same thing is true about life lived with wisdom. Wisdom needs to be consistent. There needs to be a trajectory. We need to stay steady in our wisdom and be careful of those one or two off moments when we do something foolish. Then, can you tell a fool by his walk? Sooner or later, people who live foolishly, who live without the fear of God, who live without any constraint, who live without any boundaries, who don't seem to care a lot about the long term, who just live for the now, sooner or later, that catches up to them. And sooner or later, foolishness starts to show itself on the outside. I've seen this in people that I work with. I've seen this in people that I work within my consulting business. I've seen it as a pastor. I've seen it in my own life where I've gone through seasons of foolishness. And everybody around me says, yeah, well, we knew that a long time ago. We could see it like months ago, years ago, that thing you were doing because it just showed up in your life. And that's what Solomon is talking about. Then he says, okay, let's shift the context to work. The angry boss. How many of you have ever worked with a supervisor or a coworker or a boss or a leader who got angry? How many of you haven't? I want to work with you. So he's simply saying, you know what? Bosses are human too. Whether they're right in their anger or wrong in their anger, if you panic, panic leads to foolishness. Because we make decisions based on what will alleviate our anxiety in the moment, and we don't think about the long term. So Solomon is really saying here, when someone gets angry at you, don't respond with over-the-top anger. Don't run. Don't do something foolish. Take a breath. Maybe take two. Maybe take as many breaths as you need to be calm and to respond out of calmness. Why? Because you can always choose other methods of response. But once you respond to somebody in anger, you can't take that back. Once you respond foolishly, you can't say, oh, let me dial that back. So again, practical wisdom. When someone lashes out at you with anger, the first approach ought to be, don't panic, get calm. There's a wider perspective here. And then he says, life is unfair at work. Just consider this real quick. This piece of bad business I've seen on the earth, an error can be blamed on whoever's in charge. How many of you have ever been in charge of something and been unfairly blamed for something simply because you were the leader? It kind of comes with the territory. If you're going to lead something, whether it's a small group or a church or a business or a family, sooner or later, it's real easy to say, well, it's her fault because she's in charge. And Solomon's saying that's unfair, but it still happens. And then he goes on, immaturity is given a place of prominence while maturity is made to take a back seat. How many of you have ever seen someone who's mature and wise and seasoned and skilled not chosen for the role? And somebody else chosen for the role who doesn't have the skill, doesn't have the maturity, but they're chosen for, who knows, diabolical reasons. Maybe there's a power relationship or something. I see that happen in corporations all the time. I've coached executives who said, Glenn, I'm clearly the right person for this job. And everybody says it. Even my boss said it. Here it is in my last performance review. And then sure enough, the next opportunity comes up and I didn't get the job. Now, sometimes that may not be the case. But Solomon's saying quite often the right person for the job might not get picked because life is unfair and life is unfair at work. That's why we have HR departments, because HR departments need to come in and say, wait, whoa, whoa, wait a second. Let's do our best to make the ground equal for all. Let's really have merit-based performance reviews. Let's make sure that people who are skilled and who are mature are being rewarded in commensurate ways. And the best HR departments do that. The best HR, that's what Solomon's arguing for here, is having a great HR department. I mean, he's making the case that life is unfair, so we need to do things to mitigate against the fact that bosses can be human. Okay, don't raise your hands, but how many of you have ever been in the position of picking someone and you picked your favorite instead of the best? I mean, no one in here would ever do that, but I have seen it happen on this earth. And that's what he's saying. He's saying this is what happens at work. Here's another one. I've seen unproven upstarts riding in style while experienced veterans are put out to pasture. Anybody ever hear of age discrimination in the workplace? It happens. It happens. And Solomon's saying, be wise. Figure out ways to work around that. One guy came to me for some career coaching, And he was talking about he's in his early 50s and making a jump. And he said, I think I'm being unfairly biased because of my age. And I said, well, what companies are you, you know, looking to get hired by? And he named a few of them. And I said, well, have you done any research? Have you checked out their HR records? Because one of the things about social media is you can find out a lot about companies. And some of the companies that he was applying to, there were information boards where other people had said, I think they have an age bias. I said, you can either keep banging your head against the wall, or in your field, why don't you research the top 10 companies that you'd love to work for that are ranked as best companies to work for by Inc. and Fortune 500 and all these, and then try to apply and make sure that you understand their HR protocols and how they work to protect against age discrimination. And sure enough, he did that, and he had a much better time of working because he worked with some companies that didn't have an age bias, that made sure they had policies and procedures in place to make the ground equal. Now, all of that Solomon said in just this short paragraph, because he's talking about wisdom, how to play this out in life and at work. So then he continues with principles for daily living. In verse 8, he says, consider the downside. So caution, the trap you set might catch you. Warning, your accomplice in crime might double-cross you. If you go out, he's using a hunting metaphor here. If you go out and set a bear trap, you better remember where the bear trap is. Because you might step in it, and the bear trap won't say, oh, wait, you're my owner. You set me. I won't snap on your leg. It will snap on your leg or anyone else who steps in it. So consider the downside. Just make sure. Then he says, your accomplice in crime might double-cross you. How many of you have ever heard somebody who went into business with somebody else who was a friend, maybe, heaven forbid, a family member, and then later on there was a double-cross? I have been the victim of that in my life. I've seen that happen a number of times. Solomon's saying, whenever you go into something, always consider the upside and the downside. It doesn't mean you shouldn't go into business with somebody like that, but consider the downside. I was consulting with a company about 8-9 years ago, and it was two best friends. They had met in third grade, and they'd gone through life together, all elementary school, junior high school, college. And then after college, they decided to start a company together, and they did really well. And then 9/11 hit, and they were in the computer business, and a bunch of things started to come undone. And they started to fight. Best friends for most of their lives, and they started to fight to the point where it got down to fisticuffs one day in their office. I mean, this is downtown Michigan Avenue, 20th floor, executives going to fisticuffs in the conference room. And they called me in to do some consulting, and I said, do you have a shareholders agreement? Do you have an operating agreement? Do you have key man insurance? Do you have all the protections that you would have put in if you would have been partnering with somebody that you didn't grow up with? In other words, Solomon's saying, go ahead and go into business with somebody. Go ahead and do some of these projects, because life is filled with opportunity and you have to take some of the opportunity, but protect the downside. If you have contracts and other things in place, it makes it a lot simpler, a lot easier to clean things up when they go south. Again, very practical wisdom that's very relevant for today. Then he goes on with a discussion of timing. Only he uses a metaphor. He can say, listen, make sure your timing is right. You know, the better late than never, or those kinds of aphorisms or colloquialisms. Well, he puts it differently. He says, in verse 11, if the snake bites before it's charmed, what's the point in then sending in for the charmer? Day late and a dollar short. Right? Timing is everything. He's using a kind of a strange analogy to say it's pointless after you've been bitten by the snake to send in the charmer. So consider the timing of things. Wisdom applied after its usefulness is used up is no longer wisdom. Wisdom has a context. It has a shelf life. It has a place where it's good and a place where it's kind of not good. And that's what he's saying. As you're considering things in your life, decisions that you're making, there's a timing to things. There's a best time, and then there's a not-so-good time. And we need to be wise about those things. He keeps on going in verses 12 to 14. The words of a wise person are gracious. The talk of a fool self-destructs. His point really is words matter. How many of you have ever heard somebody say, "Oh, it's just talk"? There's no such thing as just talk. Our talk indicates what's in our heart. What's in our heart indicates where our motivations come from. Our motivation is what leads us into that steadiness of life. So words matter. How many of you have ever had somebody come to you and say, "That was a really wonderful thing you did, but everything before the but is now gone. So watch where you put your but." That's what he's saying. I mean, this isn't any big stuff. This is the stuff of everyday life. We use thousands of words every day, and they matter, and we can't just throw them away because our actions and our words need to match. Here's another one that I love hating. I hear this in business all the time. It's not personal. It's just business. Baloney. Businesses are made up of persons. That's why you have human resource departments, because they're humans. And when I have something to say to you, I need to give you critical feedback, but I can do it in a way that builds you up and moves you forward and helps you grow, as opposed to attacking you and tearing you further down. Fools rush in and blah, and their words just go all over the place and they hurt. Sticks and stones may what? But words will never hurt me, which is, there's a Hebrew word for that. Joan just said it. Baloney. Words hurt. On the way here this morning, I was listening to a podcast. The actor Kevin Costner was being interviewed. Most of you know who Kevin Costner is. Dances with Wolves is probably his most famous picture. But he did The Bodyguard with Whitney Houston and a bunch of other major movies. Great actor, I think. And the interviewer was asking him some questions about how he approaches life. And Kevin Costner was saying, "I hate it when I go into a store or a restaurant and the waiter tries to help me understand that if I just give him another dime, he can give me a dollar back." And I thought, well, that's odd. Why would you? And he said, but because I hate doing math in the moment. And the interviewer said, well, why would you hate doing math in the moment? He said, because I'll never forget when I was in fourth grade and I got sent to the board to do mathematics. And the teacher said, "I want you to show your work, long division and mathematics." And she pushed me and she ridiculed me and she made fun of me and she let the other fourth graders make fun of me and laugh at me. And they started calling me names, and she did it several times that year. And it hurts. And it hurts to this day. He said, that's why, but he said it had a payoff, because now when I'm directing, I sometimes use a big whiteboard, because when I talk to an actor and I say, during this scene, I need you to enter here, walk here, fall here, get up here, and exit here, if the actor looks at me like, huh? Then I take out a whiteboard and I whiteboard it for them, because maybe they're a visual learner and I don't want to be that same teacher who causes my actor pain. And that's what Solomon's saying. Words matter. They hurt. How many of you have ever been hurt by somebody else's words? Well, let me put it another way. Is there anyone in here who's not been hurt? Who's never been hurt by someone's words? Well, is there anyone in here who's not hurt somebody with their words? Again, these seemingly small pearls of wisdom that have big ramifications. The scriptures are filled with teaching about how to use our words. Jesus talked about it. Paul talked about it. The New Testament talks about it, because our words are part of who we are. When we share a word, it's part of our being. So Solomon is saying, take words seriously. Then in verse 15, he goes on and he uses something that's probably not as familiar to us. A decent day's work so fatigues a fool they can't find the way back to town. So in those days, a worker might go out to the fields and get hired on to a day crew at a farm to do, you know, whatever task they had at hand. And he's saying that some people who do that are doing it as a steady means of income. And they're going to save that money and they're going to come back the next day and the next day and the next day and try to get hired on permanently. And they have a plan. They know how to get home and they know how to get back. They know how to get home, they know how to get back. But a fool goes out to the field and says, I just need to make enough for beer money today. And then they come back and it's like, I don't even remember my way back to town because they don't have any regular patterns of life. There's no direction, no purpose, no values, no plan. And Solomon's saying that's not a good way to live. Occasionally, you do have to respond to life without a plan because life throws curveballs. But he's talking about in the regularity of our life, if you don't have some sense of a purpose and plan, pretty soon you'll become like a fool and you'll just make a little bit of money and it'll just be beer money and you won't find your way home. In Cabo, we had a great experience. I highly recommend that all of you travel outside the United States at some point in your life. It just gives you bigger perspective. I don't know what your perspective on Mexicans is, but I had a phenomenal time. The dive master was Mexican, one of the best dive masters I've ever been with, smart, knowledgeable, multilingual, and just sharp. And the people that served us at these hotels were great. And we met one waiter who said he used to live in Acapulco, but it got too dangerous, and he moved up to Cabo. And he was serving us dinner and just having a great conversation, telling us about raising his kids and about working 9 years to save up enough money. And now he's got a house. Part of it he's built himself. He's got a plan, and he's making it work. And he's doing great work, and he brought this wonderful serving spirit to us. We went down there with some friends who celebrated 30 years of marriage, and I got to do their wedding vow renewal. And we did it at this restaurant, looking out over the Sea of Cortez and the sun setting, wonderful scene. And that waiter came out and said, oh, the wait staff wanted to honor you, so they made a special chocolate cake, happy anniversary, and they brought out champagne for everybody on the house. Just did that on the house. And I thought, well, I mean, brought a tear to my eye. And then he said, yeah, but my brother's not so good. My brother got involved in drugs, and he told me a story about how his brother just would come to work. He got him a job, and his brother would come to work, but after a couple days, he had enough for beer money. And he went and got lost and lost the job. And that's what Solomon's talking about. There's a wise way to live, and then there's a way of foolishness that sooner or later leads to destruction. Then verses 16 to 17. Unlucky the land whose king is a young pup. Unlucky is the country, the nation, the land, the city, the town, you name it, with a leader who's immature in skill and capacity and thoughtfulness. Whether you agree with them or not, there's a maturity level that we hope our leaders have. And unlucky is the land whose princes party all night long. I was reading some stories a couple years ago during the last election season, although it seems like it never ends, the election season. I can't remember where one ended and I know it does because people change in office sooner or later. And I remember reading stories about both conventions and what was happening in the city at night during the convention. And Republicans and Democrats were just as guilty of going out and, let's just say, doing things that I don't know that leaders ought to be doing in public, sexually and with liquor and all of that stuff. And Solomon is simply pointing that out. The tongue-in-cheek thing here is, he's probably got personal experience with this. Because while these leaders are partying, they're not taking us seriously, and they're not getting done the business of leading the country. So then he keeps on going, throw the party at the right time, verses 16 to 17, where the princes behave themselves and don't drink themselves silly. He's not saying it's never time to have a celebration. there's clearly times for celebration and party, but if that's the way you're living, if that's the way you're leading, then something's wrong. The timing of the party, when there's something to celebrate, to do it, that's wise. If you're just living a life of frivolity, that's not wise. He keeps on going in verse 18. Verse 18, a shiftless man lives in a tumble-down shack. A lazy woman ends up with a leaky roof. Get busy, get it done. If your roof is leaking, fix it. Or find somebody to fix it. Because if you don't, what happens? It keeps leaking, it gets mold in the attic, it runs down the wall, you got to replace the wall, then it runs down to the carpeting, got to replace the carpeting, sooner or later it gets into your electricity, and pretty soon what is a several hundred dollar problem becomes a several thousand dollar problem. If you got a leaky roof, the wise person says, I got to fix the leak. The foolish person says, I'll get it next week. It's classic wisdom, and maybe that seems to you like common sense. That's precisely the point. Solomon says sometimes common sense isn't so common, so let's put it down here in paper, in writing, in the scriptures to make sure that God's people fix their roof. Number verse 19, laughter and bread go together, wine gives sparkle to life. And this is a Hebrew way of telling you something, saying these things are good, and then this thing is pretty good, but it's money that makes the world go round. And that's a Hebrew way of saying you can have laughter and bread, and you should have a little wine because it adds sparkle. But if you don't have an emergency fund for your leaky roof, then your laughter will go away because now you'll have a leaky roof and nothing to repair it with. So money can be used wisely or it can be used frivolously. And then verse 20, don't waste your breath. Don't badmouth your leaders, not even under your breath. Don't abuse your betters. Loose talk as a way of getting picked up. His image there is really saying, look, who are you to badmouth people? Because as much as you're badmouthing people, somebody probably is badmouthing you. And you don't want to overhear that somebody is badmouthing you. You're not helping the situation. If you have a disagreement with somebody, a leader, great. Disagree in a public forum in a way that's respectful and honoring of the God that you serve. But the constant, just gets old and it doesn't accomplish anything. And it wears you down because you've only got a certain amount of psychic, emotional, spiritual energy. And if you're spending it on the, it doesn't accomplish anything, and it puts your nerves at a fray. And then pretty soon you start using words that you don't mean to, and you hurt people, and you make foolish decisions. And the next time your boss gets angry at you, you flash too. He's wrapping this whole thing up by saying, be careful, because all these other things can be washed away with one fly in the ointment. See how he's bringing it all? So common sense. But it's good for God's people sometimes to reflect on common sense because sometimes spirituality is just about having wisdom. So let's talk about this. The benefits of wisdom from what we've collected so far. Because do you believe it? We're already 10 weeks into the 12-week study. Wisdom can keep us from harm, can spare us embarrassment, can bring us long-term joy, help us make sound decisions, lead us in living with integrity, make us more healthy, and differentiate us from fools. That's the benefits, and then there's probably more. You can tease out more, but those are the benefits of wisdom. So now let's add what Jesus might say to this. First, I want to say that Jesus understands that the world in which we live is evil. He would agree with Solomon that life is unfair, that life is sometimes evil, that there are evil forces. Jesus is called in Luke chapter 4. Let me read a portion of that for you. And this is picked up also in Matthew 12, and I think that's the verse that's cited for you in your notes. Let's see, where am I? Luke. Yes, so Jesus is tested. He's baptized, and then it says the Spirit drives him out into the wilderness where for 40 days he fasts. Satan tempts him three times. Jesus challenges him with the word of God. And then the angels come and minister to him. Then Jesus comes out of the wilderness by the Jordan, and it says in Luke chapter 4, verses 14 is where I'm picking up the story. Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit. News about him spread through the whole countryside. He was teaching in their synagogues, and everyone praised him. He went up to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and on the Sabbath day he went into the synagogue, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it's written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him. He began by saying to them, "Today the scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. "Is this really Joseph's son?" they asked. And I read that passage because one of the things that was true about Jesus that guided all of his life is that he was very clear about his mission and his purpose in life. So he wouldn't be like the day laborer who went out to get a day's wages and then come back and can't find his way back to town. Jesus is clear about what his mission is and what his purpose is. And all of you have a mission and a purpose and good works that God has appointed for you to do. And our job is to continually find out and understand from God, where are you leading me, so that I can say no to the other things and yes to the great things, because that's the depth of wisdom out of which we want to live. So Jesus knows his calling and purpose. Jesus engages evil head on, and Jesus uses his power for justice. Solomon is contrasting an angry boss, an immature leader, and he says, be careful when you're working with these people. Well, Jesus is a person who's got power. He's the only rightful king of the only kingdom that matters. And when Jesus said, when you've seen me, you've seen the Father, we need to understand that he's saying, this is how power ought to be used. Carefully, thoughtfully, lovingly, with mercy, with grace, to overturn injustice. That's what he says. He says, he sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free. That's to overturn injustice. Jesus uses his power to correct things where people have been treated unfairly or poorly by the system. So the best part of wisdom that Jesus would say is if you have power, use it for God's glory by restoring things. Don't use it to tear things down. Use it to restore things. Then Jesus goes on in Luke 6, and I think your notes say Luke 7 or something like that. It should say Luke 6. My bad, that was my editing. I was doing foolish things that day apparently. 6:43. No good tree bears bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. What I want you to hear here is Jesus is thoroughly immersed in the wisdom culture of the Hebrew people. This is Jesus now giving you words of wisdom. No good tree bears bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. If you're, and here's what he's going to go on to say, each tree is recognized by the works that it does, the fruit that it bears. People do not pick figs from thorn bushes or grapes from briars. A good person brings good things out of the good stored up in their heart, and an evil person brings evil things out of the evil stored up in their heart. For the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. That's why the scriptures say, watch your words, because it's an indicator of something deeper. When my words don't match my faith, there's a disconnect. And Jesus says, that tells you something's the matter in your heart. One of the ways to capture that is through journaling, where I've journaled some things and I've gone back and thought, did I say that to Pastor Greg? I don't know if I meant to say it that way. Did I say that to Pastor PJ? Maybe I should have used different words. Because I, too, have to be careful of my heart. So do you. So then he goes on, and here he picks up wisdom again, verse 46. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? That's another way of saying what Solomon has said earlier. The wise person has fear of the Lord and obeys. What does Jesus say? Why do you say to me, you're the Lord, you're the Lord, and then you go off and do whatever you want. You don't obey. Same thing as Solomon. As for everyone who comes to me and hears my words and puts them into practice, I will show you what they are like. They are like a person building a house who dug down deep, laid the foundation on rock. When a flood came, the torrent struck that house but could not shake it because it was well built. But the one who hears my words and does not put them into practice is like the person who built a house on the ground without a foundation. The moment the torrent struck that house, it collapsed and its destruction was complete. Wisdom. Build on a good foundation. In Cabo, it was interesting to see. We're driving to downtown area, and there were a couple of hotels along the cliffs that had just been wiped out by a hurricane that came 2-3 years ago, sitting right next to other hotel. I mean, literally 20 feet from another hotel that's, there it is, standing, clear and tall, open for business, while the one right next to it is shut down, being rebuilt because the construction was different. And I thought, I wish I could put that picture as a little video that would pop up when you read this. Jesus is using the same kind of wisdom that Solomon is. Look at these physical attributes of the world. Your life is the same. Build on deep foundation. This is what Jesus would say is the deep foundation. Following the Spirit, knowing your mission, knowing your purpose, and constantly reflecting on the Word. So that's what Jesus would say about living a life. He would say, live a life of blessedness. Seek out blessedness. We're going to start next week with reading the Beatitudes, but right now I want to finish. It's about 10:29 I have. I want to finish with something that I think transitions from what life can be like when we live out of wisdom, connects it with Thanksgiving, and brings it from modern culture. Any of you watch The Voice? How many of you have ever watched American Idol? So glad that's shutting down. Did I say that? Sorry about that. If that was your favorite show, foolish words, here we go. But The Voice is this, it's this, I think, wonderful show where you start out with a blind audition. So the four judges are facing away from you, and you come out and you sing, and they either turn their chair around or not, and it's based entirely, at least that first moment is based entirely on the sound of your voice. Not whether you're cute, hot, smart, sexy, whatever, but just the sound of your voice. And when you watch it and you go, wow, that person looks weird, but man, they can sing. And then they go through and they narrow it down, and somebody ends up being the winner. Well, there's this guy who comes from a southern culture. He's a big guy, really big. His name's Jordan Smith, and he's got a voice like, oh, angels would long to have a voice like this, I think. And so when they get down to narrow it down to the real competition, they get to pick their own songs. And one night last week, he picked a song that surprised everybody because it's a classic hymn. And he sang it, and it's now right up in the top 10 of iTunes. Because people, it doesn't matter whether you're a Christian or not, you're going, there's just something blessed about this. So let me play that for you, and hopefully that will bless you as we head out to Thanksgiving.
Great is thy faithfulness, O God, my Father, there is no shadow of turning with thee. Thou changest not, thy compassions, they fail not, as thou hast been. Morning by morning, new mercy.
The backstory is he grew up singing in church and his mom was there crying, and he said, at this point in the competition, I just have to give credit to where this voice comes from. It comes from an almighty God who blessed me, and I want to use it to bless people. And he sang it the week after Paris, and the four judges, Adam from Maroon 5 and Gwen Stefani and Pharrell Williams and Blake Shelton, were all in tears, and the whole place just sat there. And he lives a life of wisdom. He's a big guy. And you, if you first see him, you go, I don't know if you look like a star. When you hear his voice, and he sings all the pop songs too, but he just said, let me sing the most important one. Let me just tell you where all this comes from. And no matter what, even if I lose today, tomorrow morning, his mercies will be new. That's wisdom, friends. That's life. That's how you thrive. Let's pray. Lord God Almighty, thank you for life. Thank you for Solomon. Thank you for Cabo San Lucas. Thank you for snow. Thank you for sisters and brothers in Christ, for small groups. Thank you for leaders who are trying to figure out how to stop the craziness of ISIS. Thank you for policemen and firemen and Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and people around the world who stand in harm's way. Thank you for all that you give us in this life, as crazy and strange and out of control as it is. Tomorrow, your mercies will be new. Most of all, thank you for your Son, Jesus Christ, who gave his life for us that we might thrive. In Jesus' mighty name, and all God's sisters said, have a great Thanksgiving, folks.